With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, welcome back to In the Pink with me, Natalie Pinkham, and Bose, helping you stay connected and offering you a bit of peace and quiet amidst the madness with their noise-cancelling headphones, a pair of which, by the way, you can still win. Just keep listening to find out how. Okay, this week, my guest is the legendary DJ Trevor Nelson. Trevor is obviously a household name when it comes to R&B and soul music, a firm favourite at BBC Radio for over 25 years. What you might not know about him is he's also a massive sports fan, passionate about golf and Chelsea Football Club. He also knows the odd thing or two about Formula One. Now, we talk on this podcast about his iconic show, The Lick. Remember that? On MTV. In fact, it remains MTV's most popular show of all time. He tells me about his encounters with Lewis Hamilton, including the time he was supposed to DJ at Lewis's birthday party. Find out why he couldn't. And he shares his views on Black Lives Matter, the first time he's spoken publicly about the movement. His thoughts are fascinating. Now, I have to say, of the many podcasts I've done over the last 2 years, this with Trevor is right up there with my favourites. In fact, he could well be standing on the top step of the podium for me. I think over the next hour, you'll hear why. Here he is, Trevor Nelson on In the Pink. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Trevor Nelson.
Indeedy, naturally.
How bloody lovely is it to see your face again?
It's nice to see you. Yeah. I only see you on telly these days.
Shut up.
Yeah, I only see you on telly. I always go, I know her. I used to work with her.
Yeah, talking of which, that was 2009. Now, for those listening, Trevor and I did a show together, NFL show together, way back in 2009. It was a lifetime ago. But it was good fun, wasn't it?
Oh, I'm going to put this out there now, okay? Natalie Pinkham has always been my... I mean, I'm not just saying this. Anyone who asks me, they say, who's favourite person you ever worked with? I say Natalie Pinkham. I had the best time.
Oh.
I looked forward to our little Channel 5 show every single week, only because of you.
Oh, and,
I mean, I love the NFL. You know, I was a consultant for the NFL, which no one in the world believes, right? But I was...
That's a very grown-up role.
Yeah, it was a grown-up role. I was a consultant for the NFL for a little while. But while we were trying to get American football at, you know, in the UK, real games played. So, you know, Alistair Kirkwood, lovely guy. He runs NFL UK. Soul fan. Bit of a soul boy. And he contacted me. Anyway, so when this show came up and they threw us together, we were both like, the Bears. You know,
the Bears,
I remember that. And we just had a laugh. It was great fun. You're tremendous. That's why I'm doing your podcast. I don't do many podcasts.
Well, I'm honoured.
Yeah, good man.
It's fair to say, though, that radio's really your first love, and it's something that you've done for, like, what, 25 years?
Next month will be my 30th year as a legal broadcaster.
Oh, yes, because you were illegal before that, weren't you, at KISS?
I was illegal before that, but KISS got a licence in September 1990, we went on air, and it was revolutionary. The first dance station that's got that had a license, and it was London wide, not national, but London wide, and it changed dance music in this country forever, because labels started popping up feeling that they had actually a station they could sign acts and feed them to a station that would play them 24/7, and it was great. So 30-year veteran next month. Yes,
amazing. Did you feel or know at the time that you were part of something very special in that moment?
100%. I mean, 1,000%, because, you know, all I was a record collector. I was one of these kids that, I don't know if you remember vinyl much, Natalie, when it was around back in the day, but I used to do a basic job, you know, and all my money went on record. I was obsessed with records, vinyl, and it was expensive. It was American imports. It was... So I would spend like up to £100 a week on records in the 80s, early 80s.
£100 a week is a lot now.
It was a lot. It was all my money then, right? And when I got my first credit card, vroom, maxed it out. Remember having a Visa and then, what was the opposite to Visa? I had both of my current, Access, something like that, I don't know. Both of them are maxed out on my mantelpiece. Snip, paying them off for 2 years. And I was addicted. So Kiss as a Pirate was a place where hobby DJs like me got a voice. And then all of a sudden we got a license. And I was like, oh, I can turn this vast record collection into something. And that was it.
Okay, so big moment for you. But did you recognise just how big it was in terms of the music scene?
Yeah, I did. Because after 3 or 4 years on Kiss Pirate, we knew enough people who were trying to make music, who were, you know, we started to get to know record labels, and they were, we're talking about, you know, would Prodigy be where they are today without Kiss playing their early stuff? Would so many artists, there was so Massive Attack, I remember having a world exclusive on Massive Attack's Unfinished, you know what I mean? And it was like sitting in front of me, what is this? You know, I remember getting the first Mary J tune, but you know, Arrested Development. And we were playing them to London, and London was very responsive to us. It was very exciting. And we got in, all of a sudden I was getting sent records all the time. So I knew we weren't good. We weren't very good.
Oh, come on.
We weren't great.
But there was just a massive appetite for it.
That's what I'm saying. It was.
Why hadn't that been catered for before? Earlier,
because Radio One and Capital Radio at the time were all powerful. Radio One was at the time was the old Batesy and Ben Boys and Dave Lee Travis and you know, Noel Edmonds. They were still running Radio One, and someone would be running the playlist, and the playlist was down to just a few people who weren't young or necessarily on the clubbing scene or out there on the pulse. They were just doing what they thought Radio One listeners wanted. And Radio 1 wasn't targeted at young people. I think Radio 1 was family listening. So, you know, some exciting young artist coming through that's hot in a club is not going to be reflected on Radio 1's playlist. So Radio 1 actually became what Radio Caroline came around, because what was being played wasn't what the kids wanted to hear. And then they became Radio 1. And then Radio 1 became like the total establishment, and we had to have pirate radio to nudge Radio 1. I mean, Radio 1 stole so many DJs from Kiss, it's scary. I mean, they got me, they got Giles Peterson, Dave Pearce, Judge Jules. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, and loads of producers. And it's massive influx. And
that was your training ground.
Yes, very exciting race.
Because then obviously you were at BBC and you've been linked to the BBC for forever.
Yeah.
You ducked and dived and weaved your way through the BBC ranks. What about it has been good for you, and why have you worked for them?
When you get a chance to, I'm a specialist. I'm a soul boy at heart. I'm R&B. Everyone knows, you know, me, R&B. It's sort of synonymous, you know, in this country. So when there was an opportunity for me to join, I joined in 96, Radio 1. It was like really exciting. Pete Tong had been there for a few years. You know, they had Tim Westwood doing hip hop for a couple of years. They got me, then they got Jules, they got Fabian Groovrider for drum and bass. They had it all covered, and they wanted to clean out the old school. And we lost listeners. you know, the day I joined, Chris Evans was doing a breakfast show. He was wild. He had TFI going on a Friday night and he was doing the breakfast show. It was just a bit crazy. You know, Zobel then joined and it was mad. You go into Radio 1, Fatboy Slim's hanging about, someone else is hanging about. It was just like that. And I knew that my place was R&B and I thought, okay, I want everybody in the country to know what R&B is. I want an Oasis fan to like Usher. You know, that was my mission. And everybody was superstar DJs. Remember that term? Pete Tong and all his cronies, superstar DJs, you know, they were out there doing Ibiza. And I thought, I need to get my foot in somewhere here. I need to... And broadcasting on radio at the time, there was no... We weren't filmed. No one knew what we looked like. It's just all about your voice and what you do. And it was pure. It was still pure. And for that reason, I think we're the last generation of that, you know, that era of pure radio DJ. Since then, it's been social media. Let's film our interview. Everything's filmed. Everyone wants to get more out of what they do. You know, this, what we're doing now, for example, I can see your beautiful face. And, you know, I couldn't do, that could never happen 20 years ago. So, and we could just about barely do something like this. It'd be over a phone, wouldn't it? We'd be on a phone line.
Yeah.
You know, crackly phone line.
It's interesting, though, because you call radio your safe place. And I'm often intrigued as to why people assume you can crisscross between radio and TV, because I think they're very, very different disciplines. And I think just because you're good on radio doesn't mean that it will translate on TV and vice versa.
That'd be great.
I mean, you do and have done some great television, but I feel that, yeah, it's your voice. It's your voice.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I don't know how you feel about certain people, but it's almost as if you get famous enough, you know, in the current broadcasting world, for whatever reason, whether it's a reality TV show or you're a very successful TV presenter, people just assume you can therefore have your own radio show. And I don't know if that's right.
Okay, I'm going to be controversial and be very careful what I say. Very careful what I say. But I will say, yes, I 100% agree with you. The only reason I had no ambition on TV. I had no ambition to do TV. I still have no ambition to do TV. In fact, I think if I wanted to do more television, I could have easily done more television. Rubbish television, but I could have done more television. And the simple thing was, my radio broadcasting gave me the opportunity to do MTV. And MTV was only small, let's be honest. It was on Sky. You had a tiny amount of population had MTV when I joined. I joined MTV in 98. But it was because I was a specialist. And that's why I wanted to do MTV. Because I, instead of being a VJ, you know, hey, I'm a VJ. Remember them days of, hey, I'm a VJ. And I've got a funky accent. And you know what? This is a new one from... Now, I saw, this is what killed me, Natalie. I was watching MTV because the Fugees were on, and they were my band. Fugees. They were my band, right? I love the Fugees.
Me too. It just takes me back to studying. I just remember, like, just pushing aside my books and just dancing. Yeah.
Exactly.
I loved it.
Of course you can. I was watching this VJ interview, the Fugees.
Yeah.
And I remember exactly how it went, the interview went. I'm watching, I'm thinking, okay. And bless her, she was just doing what an MTV VJ does. She says, Praz, you started the band, and Praz is like, yeah, well, you know, Wyclef's my cousin. I went to college with Lauren, and, you know, I just put the Fugees together. Wyclef, you're the genius of the group, right? I remember every word she said, and he went, oh, well, you know. Haitian Nation, and he's like, yeah, you know, you write, you produce, you da-da-da-da-da. And she went over to Lauryn Hill, who, although a troubled soul, was a one-of-a-kind performer. Just unbelievably talented. She turned around and she went, I like your shoes.
Ooh.
Right? I love those shoes.
Oh.
She didn't ask for anything of substance and continued. And I sat in my living room and I went, because to me, it's Mary J, it's Lauryn Hill, and then the rest, right? Around that time, Jill Scott and all the rest of them. And I thought, if I ever get a chance, ever, I'm going to do a substantial show on MTV if ever I get the chance. Lo and behold, I got a phone call from MTV. I went up there, did some sort of audition, very suspiciously. I said, please don't call me a VJ. That's one. When they said, you've got the show, I said, okay, can you not call me a VJ? Can I sit down? I'm a radio DJ, really. I don't really want to look. I looked at myself. I hated myself on MTV the first time I saw myself. I was like, oh. I said, who's going to teach me telly? They said, no one. I said, can you get the camera off me? So they started doing this sort of thing with me, right? While I was still talking, it worked. It worked. The show did great. And that's the only reason I did telly, because I wanted to push the music I loved so much on TV.
But The Lick was the longest running MTV show. I mean, it's like iconic. And yeah. I know you say it's niche, but it was the most popular. Like, I feel like everybody remembers The Lick.
Yeah, but it took off. I mean, the videos at the time, let's be fair, were very, you know, like Ghetto Fabulous, Hype Williams, $1 million videos, girls with booties hanging out, you know, guys with gold jewelry, and rap was the thing. It was fun. It was not to be taken seriously, those videos, but they were, I mean, iconic videos. You know, you think of so many, you know, Diddy videos, Bad Boy videos, and, you know, so many videos. And the show went to 47 countries around the world, outside of North America.
Yeah. Didn't
know that. Yeah, it was way bigger than even I felt. It was bigger in other countries than it was in this country. So I remember getting off.
This is like pre-internet. This is pre-social media.
Yeah. I got off the plane in Stockholm, and it was like everybody knew me because it was free. It was on their national television. I got off the plane in Dublin, and it was the same thing. The Irish could see it for nothing as part of their, you know. So it was in Africa. It was huge. Right now, I know. Which then gave me opportunity, you know, people saying, you know, BBC, like, what do you want to do on telly? What do you want to, you know? And so I got some opportunities to make what were niche programs on BBC television. And then that's how I ended up doing the odd thing with you and other people. But I had no TV. I didn't want to be on television massively. I still, yeah, you know, sorry.
The world continues to evolve. And the new norm isn't fully clear yet. But what does remain constant is the core message from our friends at Bose. Stay calm, stay centred, and stay connected. Communication is key in everything we do and goes a long way to nurturing both ourselves and our relationships with others. So continue to talk about what matters to you. And don't be afraid to block out unhelpful noise or indeed to embrace silence, because doing both can be great. Some of the ways we work will have changed forever. Embrace that. Make those new ways work for you. Shape the new norm to suit you. Feel more, do more, be more with Bose.
The thing is, it seems like you just have to be a specialist in order to be authentic and for the audience to take you seriously and really buy into it. And that's obviously what's given your career longevity, because you are seriously old now.
Yeah, I've given you permission to say that. I am. I'm cracking on. In fact, I got my break on MTV. When I joined MTV, I think I was the oldest presenter when I joined.
It's just as well you only look 25 then, isn't it?
You when I joined, let me tell you, when I joined, Davina McCall.
Come on.
Davina McCall. Sorry, what's that?
No, I need you to share with us why you're 57 and you could be 27. I mean, Jesus, look at you.
I have no idea. I'm not going to lie to you. I shave my head, maybe. I've always shaved my head, which keeps me looking the same, right? I mean, when I joined MTV, seriously, Davina McCall was just leaving. Russell Brand was there. Sarah Cox had been doing a show there. There were so many. June Sarpong, Richard Blackwood. It was like Kelly Brook joined at one point. It was like Cat Deeley was there while I was there. It was a bit like a who's who, Edith Bowman. We all did something on MTV at some point. Zane Lowe joined around the same time as me, Eddie Temple Morris. I was, you know, MTV Base started because of the success of The Lick. It was great. Now, like you said, going back to your point of, about reality TV stars doing stuff, I think there's no such thing as a TV presenter anymore. Do you remember when you used to put your television on and go, there's a new show and this person's the presenter, you know, and you've never seen that person before. You don't know, you know, and that was how it was. Now, everybody's got to bring something to the table. You've got to bring a fan base to television with you. So someone like Rylan, who does huge amounts on television. And when I first saw Rylan, he was on X Factor. And I was like, is he having a laugh? You know, that sort of thing. Now, I have my doubts about Rylan. And then Rylan joined Radio 2. I didn't know too much about Rylan, you know what I mean? But I knew he was X Factor. And I heard he was joining Radio 2. We did a 24-hour karaoke marathon for charity. And it, part of my show was in it, obviously, and he came in on my show. And I've got to tell you, incredibly bright, quick, really clever. I was impressed by him, to be honest. He's an everyman, you know what I mean? He does everything, let's be fair. But he is at the top of that pile, but there are several people way down there that I don't think should be on radio. Yeah. And are just there because their names. You know what I mean? He is, he's like actually
a lot of, yeah. I feel like he's very, I did one show with him once and I've just, he had a lovely aura about him. Good energy. And yeah, looked uncannily like Olivia Giroud.
and many other biblical characters that I can name with that grooming he's got going on. And incredibly cool. But no, Rylan has a place in this business, 100%, I think. But I think there are, I think we've fallen into this trap of you've got to bring something to the table. And so people, and I always thought my DJing and broadcasting was, to me, it was hello grand, mate. You know, you get to Radio 1, you work all your life to do it. It means a hell of a lot. And then you get to Radio 2 when you get to a certain age, you know, and it's the biggest station in Europe. And I'm honoured.
In the world?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
In the world, yeah.
Yeah, possibly. And I they've given me 4 shows a week now.
Wow.
So I'm, but then I sometimes wonder, and I'm not talking about Radio 2 so much, but I look at people popping up on radio stations everywhere who are names rather than broadcasters. And if the country has an appetite for that, then that's fine. And they seem to. So it's a changing, you know, it's a changing landscape.
So for you then, how have you stayed relevant, or have you got an audience that have grown with you and stayed loyal to you and you're going on a journey together?
I'm flipping Cliff Richard. I said that to, no, I tell you what, I still DJ. I do a lot of old school parties. I mean, I think the last time I saw you at one of my gigs, I was doing a gig for you.
I wanted to talk about that actually. Yeah,
and it was for the kids, and it was amazing. The charity you're really involved in. But
we met. Let's mention it now, because I'm so grateful for your time and energy that night. So it was called End the Silence, and it was all about music and how music transforms lives. And it was basically what we were doing is we were asking people to think about the one track from their childhood, the one song that takes them back to a moment. And it's based on the idea that the charity that I work for, Hope and Homes for Children, these kids have never heard music. Mm-hmm. They've never had any kind of music in their life, and they have a childhood of silence. And the creepy thing is, when you go into these orphanages, the kids don't even cry, because they learn to stop crying because nobody comes when they do. So this was this whole idea about End the Silence. We did it at Abbey Road Studios. And you just, oh my God, brought the dance floor alive.
Party, wasn't it?
It was so good.
I had a lot of fun.
So lovely, because what it did is it evoked a lot of emotion, because a lot of people were then saying, oh, my one song is. Mm. And my song was Roy Orbison in Dreams, because my dad used to sing it to me as a baby to get me to sleep. And actually, I want listeners of this podcast to let me know what theirs is, because I think it really gets people thinking. And when you hear that song, and if I ever do, it's rare because it's never really on the radio anymore, but I start crying out of nowhere. Just this emotion floods over me. And it's good. It's positive emotion, but it reminds me of my dad. It reminds me of being a little girl, feeling quite vulnerable. And music just has that ability, doesn't it?
My one is chestnut roasting on an open fire. My dad was a really disciplinarian. My dad, I was brought up in a very, put it this way, the word love wasn't mentioned that much in my house. No, it was because he was an immigrant. He came over. It was tough for him, my mum. From St. Lucia. He was a bus conductor. He was way better than that. You know what I mean? My mum was a childminder. We didn't have a lot. We grew up in Hackney. And it was this thing. You must have heard it over and over again recently about us having to work a bit harder and all the rest of it. And so we grew up in a house where there's a sense of duty. You know, my dad used to do something where he was like, son, ask me how much money I've got in my pocket right now. Anytime. And I go, Dad, how much money you got in your pocket? You go, £3.65. He'll always know because that's what he's like. He said, you should always know. He was like that. He became a financial advisor. So, you know, everything was a sense of duty. So my dad was quite a fearsome character. I was more scared of my dad than teachers, the police, anybody, right? But he at Christmas was different gravy. You know, he at Christmas, that's the day I loved my dad, you know. And my dad would be down at Christmas singing his Nat King Cole songs. And we didn't open presents until he put that song on. And, you know, I always well up when I hear that song, despite the difficult relationship I might have had with my dad all my life. You know what I mean? That song and music has that power. It's amazing. You know, I have a thing on my show on Radio 2 called Musical Youth, where I play a bit of Musical Youth. This generation rules a nation with version. And then you write in, Natalie, and you say, dear Trev, can I love the show? Blah, blah. Of course you've got to say love the show. And then you say sort of, can you please play Roy Orbison? Da, 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 da. And then you tell a little, it's not just about your parents, it's about your youth. It could be one about you raving in Ibiza or something, but you could quite easily send that in. And, you know, it's just, that's why I do it. Because when you're young and you have no mortgage, no kids, no responsibility, no headaches, no schedules, when you just, music takes you back to those carefree times, and it just, it's a power. It's a power.
It really is.
God blame me, no, sorry.
You're making me well up.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's true. You've got to have enthusiasm for music. You've got to really love it to stay in it this long. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think you struggle to find anyone who doesn't love something about music. You know, that hasn't been touched by some music and have a passion for it somewhere. But if you can make a job out of it, then wow, God, even better.
I've stolen a living, haven't I? It's not a real job, is it? It's not a real job.
Go on.
It's only a real job. The only time there are times when this is the problem with music. It's something I used to escape to. We didn't grow up with much, but I had my music. You know, I'd do any job. I could do any job as long as I had music playing. I ran a shoe shop. It was my first job, official job after leaving college. I didn't go to uni. And can you believe this? I didn't go to uni because I didn't know one person who went to uni. One of my friends. And it was free in those days, right? Because we didn't want to leave London. We were scared. We were like, I don't know. Everyone was get a trade, get a job, get a trade, get some income in, that sort of thing. So I had a part-time job in a shoe shop. And then when I left, I knew about shoes. So I became a manager of a boutique shoe shop in Bethnal Green. Yeah, boutique meant that there were three staff members. Two during the week, three on Saturday. And it was called Panessi. Italian shop, and I had obviously my music on all day. And honestly, as mundane a job as that seems, we didn't sell many shoes. As long as I had music on, I was great. But the problem was at lunchtime, sometimes I would close the shop and go to the record shop to buy some records. And I knew more about the records in the record store than the guy who ran it. So he eventually offered me a job importing music. You know, going to Heathrow, picking up loads of vinyl and running around London, selling it to all the record shops. And this is where I started learning about the record industry. So I started at the very, very bottom, and then became an assistant manager in a record shop, and then, you know, just moved on a bit, then started my own sound system, doing parties, getting a reputation in London for having music, and then I met Jazzy B from Soul to Soul.
Oh.
And that was a big moment. There you go. And he was a funky dread. He was like, he hadn't made any music, he was just a DJ. And we had this really, I had this orange mini, I remember. I pulled up outside a club and I was supposed to be running that night, and his sound system were doing a sound system for a fashion show in the same club on the night I was supposed to be there. I said, what's going on? And the guy who owned the club went, oh, double booking. Sorry, mate. I'm like, I've been doing this for 3 weeks. This is my week four. This is when I break even. This is when we start the night rolling. And I was really pissed off. And Jazzy calls me over. You mad out of Trevor? That was my name, Mad Hatter. I said, yeah. Who are you? Jazzy B, Soul to Soul. He's got this massively deep voice. We hooked up, started doing some parties. And then one day he said, I want to make some music. And I thought, you can't play an instrument. And I heard Keep On Moving back to a global bam. And I realized that dreams can come true if somebody really believes. And this guy was just from North London, same as me, you know what I mean? And he just went, boom, global. A year and a half later, he was flying me out to see him in concert in Hollywood. And I just was like, okay. And I went to Hollywood. And I'll never forget, I was in the queue at LAX airport because it was so long to get through passport control. And in front of me was Terry Wogan.
No.
Never forgotten it. Terry Wogan was totally pissed off because it was hot. The queue, it took about an hour to get through. He obviously had to get somewhere. I've never forgotten it. Went to see the concert, came out, and at the after party, there was Mick Hucknall, who was huge at the time. Huge. Just hovering around as he does, you know, and I'm like, okay, this is the life. And I went back to working in a record shop after that and thought, I've got to knuckle down, mate. I've got to really knuckle down. And he helped me focus my mind, I think, with his success, you know, but I just knuckled down and just worked really hard. It's the little office.
I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen the Mobo at the back there.
I've got loads of discs up here, girl. Look.
Mobo 97. Oh, look at that. Oh, my God.
And Amy, Corinne, Brandy, Lauren, Destiny's Child, Mariah.
Oh.
These are Plan B. Yeah, I've got loads of these. That's what you get if you... I didn't sell any of those. It's just... what they give you for playing them and giving them live sessions, oh, and stuff like that. Here you go.
Now, talking about live sessions, how impacted, I know this is a bit depressing, but how impacted have you been by COVID? Because I know you got your residency at Pasha. What's happening there? How kind of concerned are you for that, for the live music scene generally?
I don't do Pasha anymore, and I need to change that because a lot of people think I still do it, but I don't do it anymore.
Right. Yeah. You did it for, like, 10 years.
Yeah, over 10 years. But I got to be honest, Nat, I think I saw what the Chancellor did for this country, which I thought initially was fantastic, but completely admitted the entertainment industry initially. And a lot of people live hand to mouth in that business. You should know some. I know loads of people who rely on the entertainment, hospitality, and stuff like that. And they're sort of people who they don't have the sort of records that you financial records that you need in order to get the furlough cash and all that stuff. And they are on the floor. The uncertainty is absolutely killing them. You know, we know about theatres because theatres are established in this country for years. And they've always been on the brink, theatres, haven't they? But venues, live music venues, been closing every year. You know, I tour every year and I there's a venue in Leamington Spa. I love it. It's beautiful. And it was taken over. It was shut down last year, taken over. It comes back and now it's probably gone again, you know? Hackney Empire, Jazz Cafe, these places in London that are iconic, crowdfunding to survive. It's the landlords aren't letting go on the rent. They're not compromising. You know, they're being hardcore. And places, I think it's going to change forever. Sometimes people say, well, that in crisis like this, the best people survive. Fair enough. But unfortunately, they're the best people, but there are so many. It's like a spider, isn't it? For every best person, there's 8 people that depend on that person for a living. You know, somebody was showing me, I saw on TV yesterday, there was a massive warehouse of all this equipment where all big bands go to experiment with their lighting shows. And, you know, just 100 people work here. We haven't had anything for it since March, and we don't know when next. And it's a massive space with loads of equipment. I'm worried. And, you know, at my age, for example, it's all right for me to say I've done all the best gigs I'm ever going to do. And I'm happy. I've had some great memories. And I'm, you know, I'm at the age I am. I can stop gigging. I can just do radio and play golf and feed my fish and look back. But I look at my daughter, who's much younger, obviously, and it makes music and relies on that sort of living. And so many younger broadcasters and DJs and club owners and...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
People who make graphics, who make, you know, there were loads and loads of people. And I don't know. You can't blame the government. It's just a pandemic.
It's a terrible, surreal situation. Maybe... through adversity, some beautiful music will be made. I mean, that's going to be a hope, isn't it? That it's the creative juices. But it's, you also worry that young people just can't afford to pursue their passion and pursue their dream of becoming an artist or whatever they want to do in the music industry.
Well, I don't think so much there, because the reliance isn't on performing live. You don't have to tread the boards anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Young stand-up comedians might have a problem. Yeah. You know, people who need a crowd in front of them and need a response. You know, music now is done on a laptop a lot of the time. You know, a lot of people, music makers, are making it on laptops. In fact, it's fine for them in a certain way. You know, it's the club owners. It's the club scene was dying anyway. It's been dying. It's a bar culture now more than a club culture.
Yeah, but I mean, there's no substitute, is there, for going to a live gig, going to a festival, all that energy that you get from something that may never happen. Well, I mean, like, I'm hoping obviously we get back to that at some point, but it doesn't feel like any time soon, because even like with sporting events, the testing process, it's going to have to be so rigorous in order to get fans back to sport and to go back to live music venues. A lot of people will be put off forever.
Yeah, I agree. I think people, I think, you know, I'm a massive football fan, right? I don't think football's going to have a problem because football is so popular at the moment that there's a waiting list for season tickets in the Premier League. I'm a Chelsea season ticket holder over 20 years. And I guarantee you, the moment I let my season ticket go, it's gone. and it's not going to come back until we get a bigger stadium. So that's not a problem. Other sporting events, the sport you're involved in, Formula One, I thought it was okay without a crowd, considering, you know, because of the noise when the driver and the focus that the drivers have. You know, I've been to Silverstone and, yeah, I've been in the paddocks. Is it the paddocks? Yeah, the pits.
Yeah.
Paddock, yeah. It was Lotus. I was with Lotus. I was with Lotus.
Woo! Well, that would have been a while ago then.
I think Grosjean was driving for them then.
Yeah, get you.
Yeah, and I had the old headphones on, in you know, the noise reducing. My God, the noise, the energy. It was so thrilling. But I figured, I said to myself, the drivers can't hear the crowd. Surely not when they're driving.
No, I think they get a bit of an energy off the crowd. Like if you talk to Lewis Hamilton, for example, at the British Grand Prix, he definitely gets a lot of energy from the crowd, and he often crowd surfs afterwards once he's won the race.
Yeah.
He didn't win last weekend, but there you go.
I remember when Lewis had a Mini. Lewis used to drive a Mini. He took me on a track once when he was, before he got a Formula One, he was a black driver. I was doing my MTV show. And I was doing another show for the BBC, and I met him twice actually. And I knew he was going to be a superstar. And you know, he was quick, man. I remember I was driving a Jag, and he was like, "What are you doing in that?" And he had a Mini, and I said, "Can you tell me the way out of the track to you know, back the motorway?" And he completely ripped me.
I love it.
But he's done incredible. I think, yeah, he's done amazing. We share the same birthday.
There you go.
I'll give you a little story. So I met him a couple of times, and I think we exchanged numbers. Yeah, we did exchange numbers. Yeah, I had quite a few numbers from you. But, and I said, I hope you get a Formula One ride next season. I think I'm going to get one next season. I said, well, good luck, and blah, 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 blah. And then I get a call. My office got a call. Oh, it's my doorbell. My office got a call, and it was his dad. We've never spoken to his dad before. He says, hi, I'm Lewis's dad. I said, oh, all right. He said, I want to do a surprise 21st birthday for Lewis. I think it was his 21st. And I want you to DJ. Can you DJ? And I said, well, yeah, you know, I might do, and all this stuff. So when is it? He goes, the 7th of January. I said, that's my birthday. I promised the wife dinner. So I never did it. I never heard from his dad again. But I never did it. And it was just like, and we sort of lost contact. But he always said to me, you should come to a Formula One race. I said, I'd love to come to Monaco. I never did it. I was so busy. I was gutted.
Oh, my God, you definitely should.
Gutted. But
one thing that Lewis is, I mean, hugely passionate about, and he's got behind various causes over the years, but this one has really kind of inspired him, motivated him, is the Black Lives Matter movement. And he's really kind of helped us in Formula One learn, understand, educate, evolve. I mean, would you believe that we are 88% male, 91% white?
Yes.
In the Pink and Bose want to support you in whatever way we can during these uncertain and constantly evolving times. So we're giving away more noise-cancelling headphones to bring some added calm to your life. To win the headphones, just tag in the three friends you're most looking forward to reconnecting with once lockdown is fully lifted. Always include the hashtag Bose, and those headphones could be yours. Good luck. And stay connected.
But something else that I saw recently was documentary The Real Thing story.
Yes.
And you did you
read on it. Yeah.
And for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's all about the song "You to Me at Everything." Okay, I really can't sing. You should take over that bit.
You can't.
It was the first black band to get a number one hit. They're out of Liverpool. Everyone thought they were American, right? Mm-hmm. And one thing, and this was only, what, back in the late 70s. One thing you said on that documentary was that you used to, like, punch the air if you ever saw a black person on television. Mm-hmm. Because it just didn't happen. Is that really true? You just didn't ever see black people on screen?
I can tell you, I'm happy to talk about it. I can tell you that it's very difficult. I talked to a lot of my white friends about this. And in this last few months, a lot's gone on. And a lot of white colleagues or friends of mine, mainly colleagues, to be fair, love talking to me because they're not afraid to make a mistake talking to me or feel people are walking on hot coals right now. They don't want to say the wrong thing. And it's counterproductive. We need to talk a lot more. And it was like that. My mum would be on the phone to a friend going, "Hey, put ITV on. There's a black person on ITV." Honestly, it was like that. It seriously was like that. We were, it's crazy. But that's how it was. And you're not to think that. You know, I don't look at you and say, "Didn't you realise, Natalie?" Of course you're not going to think that. You know, I grew up watching, you know, who's my first crush on telly? Probably looking at someone on the Avengers or someone. Probably someone like Purdy or something. You know what I mean? When you're a little kid, you are indoctrinated to see beauty as it is on telly. You know, Blondie, when we were at school, none of us knew she was in her 30s, but we're all like 15, oh, Blondie, or, you know. But, you know, it's just the way it was. I've got to tell you, it's been interesting the last few months, but it's also been exhausting. Been really, really exhausting. Things you take for granted, so such a big deal to us as black people, you know. Lenny Henry was about the only person who ever cut through on telly. I can tell you the bunch. Charlie Williams was a comedian from Yorkshire or somewhere. Kenny Lynch was an old school Jimmy Tarbuck's mates, these lot are. That's how far back we're going. Love Thy Neighbour was a very racist comedy that was on telly. The guy who's in EastEnders, Patrick, he was in Love Thy Neighbour when he was young, and it was him bickering with a white neighbour. Their two families bickering. The women were always great. The wives were great, but it was the husbands that were bickering. And they used, you know, racist terms. And Alf Garnett, that was probably the most racist programme on television. And it was, and then you had comedians constantly taking the mickey out of, you know, Jim Davison, Chalky, and doing all these, and it was all, everyone laughing, and it was fine. And Bernard Manning used to be on telly, and you know, you're used to this. You get indoctrinated by seeing this. So when you see someone who's just not playing a stereotype role, although just about every black person on telly had to at the time, when I saw Sidney Poitier in a movie with dignity, you know, proper dignity, and he was a star, and he overcame bigotry, and he kept, I was like, wow, he's my hero. You know, so it was a big deal, and it wouldn't have been a big deal to many people apart from black people, because we were represented one way and one way only. So when people say to me always, "Oh, you've got a career, your career is, you've had a great career, Trevor," and you're like, and they go, "How did you plan it?" I didn't plan shit. I didn't expect to be on radio. One, are you crazy? My aspiration was get a job, have a nice wife, be able to buy a house and go on holiday once a year. That was my aspiration. End of.
Why? Because you're black. You didn't think you would be able to have a career like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've had these conversations now with, I had a private chat with the managing director of the BBC, and I love him for it, Bob. And we have this sort of conversation. You know, people would love me to be, there are certain activists who would love me to be on social media banging a drum. I'm too old for that. I'm not talking to you unless I can see your eyes. This is too important. Do you get what I mean? I'm not going to write something to make myself feel good and get a few likes. I want to look you in the eye and talk to you or speak to you and talk to you about race. I'm not afraid to talk about race. And I'm not one of these, I understand it from both sides. And that not many people want to take that stance. You know, you're an activist or you're for or you're against. You know what I mean? Lewis is in a really, really incredible position. And what he's doing, I know what he's doing. I mean, of all the sports in the world, that is the most privileged for me. One of the most privileged, right? You can't get into that sport. His story is fantastic. Anyway, there should be a movie down the line about him. He's forcing the agenda. he's really, it must be rocking the boat and upsetting a few people up there, I'm sure. But you know what? He's the world champion. If anyone can, he can. So good on him, you know, good on him.
Tell me why the last few weeks have been exhausting. As a black man, kind of dipping his toe in, watching it, observing it, but wanting something to happen.
Yeah. Because I'm constantly talking to other broadcasters and they look at me as a senior, you know, black broadcasters. I'm talking to producers. I'm talking to white producers who do black shows, you know, because it's not all, it's not, you know, I'm talking to anyone who, I'm not talking to the press. This is the first time I'm talking to anyone publicly about Black Lives Matter, because that is you, Natalie. But, you know, I think it's been exhausting for everybody. I think the saturation on television sometimes is quite patronizing. Just to me, I find it quite patronizing sometimes. I think, you know, it's all right to put, I felt it was quite organic at the beginning. I also understand that if you don't have anyone of color that you know personally, it's very, very difficult to comment or know what it's like or understand. You know what I mean? It's so difficult for people to get it. So it's, people say, forget the softly, softly. We got to bash them over the head. Just, you know, there's ways. I think it's been a good thing. The George Floyd thing was disgraceful. The woman in the park, in Central Park, when the guy said your dog should be on a lead, it's pretty much a real indication of what you're up against. He had every right to say what he said, and she gets on the phone and says to the police, there's a black man threatening me. Good thing he filmed it. Because he wasn't threatening her. He said, ma'am, you should have your dog on a lead. Pure and simple. And she is someone who has got the power to employ people, and she probably subconsciously is racist. So, you know, I've always been brought up by my parents. My parents have never, ever, ever, I give them this. I may have said there wasn't a lot of love and, you know, in the household. And I don't mean there wasn't love. My parents loved me. I mean, you know, but it was a sense of duty, getting through the day, you know, making ends meet, that kind of thing, which was instilled in me. But they never, ever, ever said to me anything racist. They suffered racism, but he never transmitted it to me. Do you know what I mean? They always had friends. They judge people on the person. And thankfully, I'd like to think I've done the same thing in my life. And that's all we need in this world. That is the only criteria. An idiot's an idiot. A good person's a good person. I could swear and I'm tempted, but I won't. You know what I mean? But you know what I mean? And it's no different to, I'm so sure of myself in this that I don't need to look at Twitter. I don't need to look on social media. I don't need to look at anything to tell me what I am, who I am, how I should act, who I should speak to, who I should befriend, who I should mix with, who I should date, who I should anything. I don't need to be told. I educated myself on the past, the black history. I watched Roots. That's what did it. I was 10 years old. Roots came on telly. I cried. My whole family cried. I went to school angry the next day. Really angry. Because Roots was the first I'd really heard about slavery properly. We weren't taught it at school. So then I realised where I came from. And I felt a sense of massive displacement, massive not knowing. Because I used to grow up thinking, why am I here? What is it? I don't get it. What's going on? But, you know, it's cold. And I didn't get it as a kid. You know what I mean?
You look different to the other kids.
Well, yeah, but I don't think...
Part of the black community.
I was part of a black community, which made me feel, you know, Hackney was a mixed community. Our road was the United Nations. We had Irish, Turkish, Africa. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful community. Yeah, it was so much fun. It was fun. I loved my road. I loved the way I was brought up. I loved Hackney in the old days. And but when you get to the sort of critical age of 10, 11, 12, teenage... You start noticing different things, you know, and I started reading. And I started reading stuff I wasn't taught at school. I started reading autobiographies. I read about a guy called Steve Biko, then Nelson Mandela. And then, you know, and I kind of educated myself on it. And that's, And so I realised the injustices and the way we've got to go. We've got a long, 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 long way to go. This is no easy fix. But at the same time, I realise I'm in a country that is a white country and I'm in a minority. So you look at yourself that way and you're the underdog from the get-go. So in order to get somewhere, you just have to power through and work extra hard. But the truth is, I think I've got everywhere in life because of my personality. And I think that is a massive, I'm not an angry man. You know, I'm a, you cross me, you just won't hear from me again. I'm not going to confront you. I ain't got the energy for that. There's about 30 other million that could upset me. What am I going to do? Every time someone upsets me, confront them. I'll confront people if I need to, the people that matter, the people that really, really matter, you know, put them to task. But I won't do it publicly because I think there's too much of that public shaming. I think some people deserve it, but not everybody. You've got to pick your fights. You know, you've got to pick your fights because then you just become a fighter all the time.
So were you subjected, have you been, are you subjected to racism through your career?
I'm lucky because it's black music and I'm black. So, you know, I think there were instances, yes, but more not me directly. It's more what I represent. You know what I mean? Mm. The music I represent from, particularly, we've mentioned somewhere I used to work. I don't want to put it out there. I said used to work, and someone at the very top was just upset me a little bit, you know. But for this music's sake, and for getting the artists on, and for getting that music out there, I had a mission. That was my mission. And if I, you know, didn't do that show, I thought that show was very important. Yeah. I did a Zoom chat for a guy who's writing a book on black entrepreneurship, and he and his wife works at JP Morgan, regular black couple, lovely, lovely young people who are just so positive. And I told them stuff that I've never told anyone, you know, like never, about my time at MTV, EMI and places like that. And how I was the only guy around, you know, at one point at EMI, and there were only a few of us at MTV and stuff. But my mission is that when I walk out the door, that you say, do you know what? I'd hire another one of him yesterday. I'd hire that, you know, and I think it's, do you know what I mean? That's my thing.
Very positive, yeah.
You've got a, he said, you're a trailblazer. I said, no, I don't see myself as that, but I know I am.
I think anyone listening to this will, and you are, because that's why all those producers over the last few weeks have called you. They're looking for answers, and they know you can probably give them those answers.
I can try, but you know what? If you touching back on, I know we've gone on this subject, and I'm happy. I knew we would, and I actually probably want to talk about it anyway. I knew from being on Radio 1 and existing on Radio 1, it will help every single wannabe broadcaster. You know, oh my God. I could do that. Do you know what I mean? That's more important to me than anything, the legacy. I might be, you know, I might have a checkered family history or a checkered this. I might not be the best dad in the world. Or I might not be this. But the one thing in the world I know that I was good at was doing black music radio on a mainstream station and trying to sell my culture to the nation. Do you know what I mean? And help artists sell records and let people enjoy music. And I hope loads of people have bought albums because they heard me play it or enjoy an artist. And it's really important that these youngsters come through and go, he did that, he did that, I can do that, I can do that, I can do that. I call it the Obama effect, and I'm not putting myself on the pedestal like him, but you know what I mean? When he became president of the United States, I broke down in tears. I cried like a baby. I never thought in my lifetime. You didn't have to be black to feel emotional about Obama getting there. You thought the world, wow, I've never guessed in America. Because if you've been to America, you know, the only color they like is green. They love green. That's their favorite color. Above all else, money, right? And you know, so I see this black man become president of the United States, and I'm like, I just couldn't believe it. couldn't believe it. And I was so thrilled. And I immediately said to people, don't think for one moment he's going to walk into every black neighborhood sprinkling money. He's not going to do that. His job is done. His job is to get there. His job is getting there. That was his job, getting there, because it gives you hope, you know what I mean, that anything is possible.
And now it's your job to follow and overachieve and do whatever you can.
Our jobs. It's all our jobs, you know. Yeah. And I'm, you know, right now it's a better time to be in the industry than it was before, because there are some doors opening. Although I would say every broadcaster and everybody has to feel they're there on merit.
Yeah.
It's really important. It's really important, you know, that you feel you're there on merit, because there's nothing worse than feeling you're there as a token gesture. That is not great, you know.
Very true. I don't even know if you'll remember this, but you and I were meeting to have a production chat ahead of one of the NFL shows. This is, you know, 11 years ago. And you said, where should we meet? And I said, Shoreditch House, because I knew it was near you. And you were like, oh, yeah, okay. And when we walked into Shoreditch House, do you know what I'm going to say?
I can't remember, but I know we went to Shoreditch House.
You sort of slightly rolled your eyes, and I went, what's the matter? And you went, just look around, Pinks. Do you see another black person in this whole place? And I was like, shit, no. What? No. And you went, of course you didn't, because you're white. But imagine if you'd walked into a place with me on one of my suggestions, and you were the only white person there, you would notice. And I was...
Wow.
It was a moment for me. I've never forgotten that.
Wow. Did I say that?
Yeah.
I was comfortable with you then.
Yeah.
Really comfortable to have said that to you. That's... I was... I mean, it's... Just because I can doesn't mean I do. And it's not... And honestly, it... It was on my doorstep. I was a member. I think I was a member as well, wasn't I? I don't know if I was a member. No, I wasn't yet. I wasn't a member. But I don't see myself as better than anyone. But it's odd, isn't it? That's my life in a nutshell there.
Do you know what you did in that moment? Is you started a process for me, because, you know, and I'm still learning, but... Mm. I've never forgotten that moment. And I thought, yeah, do you know what? I have to walk a mile in another man's shoes in order to, before I can even begin to understand.
I would never have said that unless I was comfortable saying that. I'm telling you now, it wasn't a thing for me, because it's been, you know, that happens all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I have membership of a lot of places that I don't use.
Yeah.
Complimentary memberships or something. But I don't, you know, I was up in, I'm not going to diss Shoreditch House, by the way. I was up in...
No. And you weren't. But you were just flagging something up to me. Yeah, and that was really important. And I thank you for it.
Although, I was at White City House the other day. And that is lovely and multicultural now. It's a bit more, you know what I mean? But then, yeah, we evolved, don't we? That was 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And now loads of young black kids hanging out in White City House doing their work. It's fantastic, you know. So
do you feel that this is a watershed moment? Because I don't know whether it's, and I'm always loath to use this term, because perfect storm always implies that, you know, the word perfect implies it's a good thing, but it feels like all these things kind of did come together at the same time, with COVID, with lockdown. There was a lot of oppression, there was a lot of frustration. There was a lot of people wanting their voices to be heard, and probably struggling a lot of people struggling with mental health issues. The George Floyd thing was this massive global catalyst at a time when people were prepared and had to listen, because we were at home, locked in and ready to absorb. So do you think that this will be the change that we need to see in the world? And do you think this will be lasting?
I can honestly say the George Floyd moment alone was seismic. I think there was outrage from any human being watching that. That was just a shock to a lot of people. It wasn't a shock to black people, especially in America. It was an absolute shock to a hell of a lot of people. the callousness, the like he's an animal. Not even, you wouldn't do that to an animal, right? It was painful. I mean, I was screaming at my television when I saw that. I'm just like, you know, are you kidding me? You know, that sort of thing, right? It wasn't in the middle of nowhere. Someone's filming it. What happened after that was strange, but I felt powerful. The fact that we were in lockdown, we were told stay in, and these young people in America, black and white, went out and weren't having any more of this. This is just too much. Yeah, they had COVID fever, being locked down. They wanted to get out anyway, and then what they were pent up. But what before that, Black Lives Matter was festering. It was up. It was like a roller coaster. You'd heard of it. People weren't totally sure about its merits or what it means, and people didn't really investigate it enough to find out. And people were happy to say White Lives Matter, which, of course, White Lives Matter. We've always known White Lives Matter. We're in a white world in that way. You know what I mean? And you know, people, it's so awful having to explain why the term Black Lives Matter came up. It should be Black Lives Matter as well, just to explain to people who don't understand it.
I do think that there has been a problem with the politicization. The Black Lives Matter is also an organization, which a lot of people aren't concerned with. But it's also a statement, isn't it? You know, Black Lives Matter, they do. And I don't think, well, unless you're deeply racist, there's anyone that would disagree with that as a statement.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it doesn't mean you buy into the whole movement and all these other stuff. But the core point is that Black Lives Matter, right? We're human beings. That's what it means. We are also, you could have a t-shirt saying, we are also human beings. Please treat us like that. That's what they mean.
It's catchy.
It is quite catchy. But what's happened since has been a bit, it's gone a bit crazy in both directions. You know, the far right and people with right leanings, are very riled up, obviously. The far left are jumping on board. You know, it's politicized totally. Those in charge, dare I say, of the countries involved at the moment, I'm not enamored with at all. And I'll leave it at that. I mean, they're more divisive than cohesive. Is that the right word I should say? They're not the adhesive. They're more like, let's rip it open and tear it up. But it is a seismic moment. I think there'll be a shift. I think there has been a shift. I don't think it's a solution. I don't think we're over any humps yet. We're nowhere near. We're at the foot of the mountain. And this has to be gradual process. It's just awareness. It's just awareness. I'm here. I'm talented. Please, you know, give me a fair crack. You know, give me a fair crack. I'm a human. I pay my taxes. I do this. I do that. Give me a fair crack. That's all. Just treat me like you treat Natalie. That is it. That's all I'm asking. You know what I mean? And people will say, well, but you've done well, mate. Ah, oh, you're all right, aren't you? Yeah, 30 years, I've been working really, really hard. And, you know, if you want to find, and everybody I know that's been a success of any kind has got a very strong personality, a very single-minded, and will power through, you know, and make a difference. And not, you know, my generation certainly didn't sit around feeling entitled. Not me coming up. We were angry. There were riots where I grew up. There were, listen, once I was going, are you looking at a good boy here, but I was walking out on the street and my mum called me back, banged the window when I was going down the road with my friends because we heard something was going on. And she said, where are you going? You come back here now. And I was like, oh, shame. And I had to walk back in, but I'm glad she did. But fast forward to the year 2020, and my nephew just had his 15-minute short story on ITV, the first of the four short stories to Black Lives Matter that he wrote, and was on ITV at 9 o'clock a couple of nights ago.
Wow! So how can we find it? What's it called?
ITV. Oh gosh, you're going to kill me. It's ITV. It was on ITV, 9 o'clock, just gone. I'll find out if it's, hang on 1 second, you might have to edit this because it'll look really bad if I don't know. His name's Jerome Buchan Nelson and he's done very well for himself. He's written for EastEnders, Hollyoaks, Emmerdale, everything. He's just, it's great. And that's what it's about. Someone, a kid who's got a chance. He was doing politics and history, I believe, at uni, and he decided, I want to be a filmmaker. And now he's doing fantastically well, under the radar, done his stuff. No nepotism, no uncle helping him, or he's just on merit. That's how it should always be. Some people don't like to hear that, but that's how it should be. So it should be. Yeah, I'm really proud of him. Really proud. There you go. It was a 15-minute short story written by Jerome Buchan. Generational.
Generational. Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that. Oh, Trevor, I could talk to you all night long. I tell you what.
We've done already, Nat.
We've been chatting for an hour and a quarter.
Wow. You got to edit it. How long's your podcast?
I don't want to edit it. I want all of it to go up. I love it. I love it so much.
We've got loads more to catch up on, haven't we?
Brilliant. You're brilliant.
I'm happy to, you know, I haven't spoken on Black Lives Matter anywhere because...
Is there anything else that you want to say about it?
No, not really. I want to say, you know, my point is being there is, you know, people... Look, I'm in radio terms, I'm a household name in radio terms. I'm not the most famous black man in the country by a long, long chalk, you know. That's probably just Elba or something like that, you know. But I think that by being there, you make a change. You know, by doing you make a change. By changing, you know, I don't want to be one of the only ones in the house. Let in the house. You know, let him in. We like him. You know, I just want people to give black people a fair crack of the whip. A fair, you know, look at their CV. Don't just look at their appearance. Don't just assume they're angry or they're this or the stereotypes. Let's find, you know, I'll tell you one place I love going to. And I'm going to give this company a plug, not because I want you to buy their products, but I engage with people. When I go to the Apple store, they always have all these young people, black, white, green, yellow, pink, running around, and they're all so engaging. I don't know how they select their staff, but I always end up in huge conversations. It's one of my opportunities to talk to young people without, you know, for no reason at all. And I always end up talking to them. So what do you want to do? What do you want to do eventually? And you know what I mean? And they're able because you need them. When you've got computer problems or you've got something, so you need these people. And they're there for you. And I always go the extra mile and just ask them stuff and talk to them. Yeah, so, like working there? Or are you just working there for a while? Where do you want to go? It's like, you know, when you talk to a cabbie who always says, this isn't my job.
Get
a cab and he goes, this isn't my job, you know. They always go, I used to be a graphic designer, just doing this, or I'm a student, or I'm studying, or I'm whatever. And I love talking to people who are interesting. Treat everybody like that. Give them a crack.
That's a really good point, because you do need them in the Apple store. So you're all ears to them. That's what we should be as a general rule.
So you're an Apple person as well, right?
Yeah.
See, you've been in there and it's really strange. It's strange, isn't it? It's strange how you are, you need them and you hear them and sometimes they're some of the most interesting, sometimes they're not, but a lot of the time I find them the most interesting people. Yeah. It's like, go to Mackie D's if you get Mackie D's. And I always used to say to people, don't laugh at people who work at Mackie D's. They're working. That could be your boss one day.
Yeah.
That person could be your boss one day. You know, I like people who work. You know, and I always have a word, but I don't buy Mackie's much, so.
Yeah. Listen, you wouldn't look that good at 57 if you did.
Maybe not. It's been lovely talking.
You too, my darling. Thank you so, so much.
Well, thank you very much, Trevor Nelson. I thoroughly enjoyed our chat together. In fact, I could have talked to him for another 2, 3, or 4 hours. Well, I say talked. I would have preferred just to listen, because he's got so many amazing experiences and anecdotes that he shared throughout his time broadcasting. And it doesn't seem like there are many people on this planet he hasn't met or worked with at some stage in his career. And I also thought he was very fair and measured and calm about Black Lives Matter. Clearly very passionate about the progress that needs to be made. but good at opening up the conversation, which is obviously what we all need to do. So thank you so much for that. Honoured that you spoke for the first time about something that clearly means so much to you on In The Pink. So thank you for that. Okay, loads more great guests on the way, and still the chance to win those Bose noise-cancelling headphones. All you have to do is tag in a couple of mates onto my Instagram page, tell us which guest you've loved and why, and add the hashtag Bose, and we could be sending those headphones to you. Thank you so much for your company and your continued support and feedback. Remember to rate, review and subscribe, and I'll see you very soon for another episode of In The Pink.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.